I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this first afternoon of spring. And the sun is out. Long winter will shortly be over. This hour of the program, we're going to be talking about drugs that come into the United States. Shortly after the death of Philip Seymour Hoffman, you'll recall we did a program on the extent of heroin and opiate addiction in this country, and we talked a little bit about treatment. Today, where are the drugs coming from? How important was the February capture of Mexican drug kingpin Joaquin Guzman? And what about opium cultivation? We have read reports from international news sources say that Afghan opium cultivation has reached a record level. Our guest has been studying this and involved in finding these drugs for a long time now at a very top level. Michael Braun is our guest, retired chief of operations of the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration, now managing partner of SGI Global. While chief of operations, he was responsible for leading the worldwide drug enforcement operations of the agency's 227 domestic and 86 foreign offices, as well as the Special Operations Division, the Aviation Division, the Office of Financial Operations, and the Office of Diversion Control and Operational Support. He's an authority in the confluence of drug trafficking and terrorist groups, and has focused the agency's efforts on the global war on terrorism. He continues to testify before Congress on narco-terrorism and other national security topics. Joined the NEA in 1985, DEA, I'm thinking of another organization. He's been a special agent in St. Louis. He's worked in Latin America, in Houston, in Los Angeles, and is with us this hour. We'll be welcoming phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're also on Twitter if you'd like to find us there at K Dunn Show. Michael Braun, thank you so much for being with us.
Hey, Kathleen, thanks for having me back again.
Yeah, our great pleasure. You've been in this business for a long time, sir. As you know, there have been a host of stories about heroin epidemics in Wisconsin, all over the country, really. Are we living through a time where there is a greater amount of heroin, particularly, and opiates coming in from other countries to the United States, or is it a pretty much normal supply?
Well, I mean, that's a great question, and I think it's important to understand that heroin has been abused for many, many, many years in our country, and the trends seem to be cyclical. There will go through periods of several years where heroin abuse and addiction increases. We get it fought back down, and when I say we, I'm talking about the experts in education, prevention and treatment, as well as law enforcement. It has an uncanny ability of rearing its ugly head time and time again. And we are apparently in another one of those periods of what appears to be significant growth. The majority of, all the heroin that's abused in the United States is coming from two places, principally, Mexico and South America. To a much lesser degree, Afghanistan. The best data shows that somewhere between 50 to 60% is coming out of Mexico now, about 40% out of South America, and then the remaining 10%, somewhere between 6 to 8% of the heroin in our country is coming from Afghanistan, and just 1 or 2% from Southeast Asia.
Mm-hmm. I have heard that a much larger percentage is coming from Afghanistan. Is that not true?
No, it's not. All the current data clearly shows that somewhere between 6 to 8% is coming from Afghanistan. Now, with that said, Afghanistan is responsible for producing about 90% of all the world's heroin supply, and the majority of that is going to places throughout Europe, to markets in Europe.
I see.
The Soviet Union, Iran, to a lesser degree, Pakistan. Lots of different markets outside the U.S.
Mm-hmm. And there has been an effort we've heard. I'm just wondering how it's been progressing to get farmers in Afghanistan to switch from growing poppies to something else. Has that been effective at all?
You know, listen, to a limited degree, it's been effective. But as long as a farmer is paid 10 times, a greater price for growing an illicit crop such as poppy as they would be paid for a licit crop, whatever that might be, the writing's on the wall. They're going to lean hard into the illicit market. But I don't want to leave your listeners with the impression that there aren't a heck of a lot of good Afghan farmers that are trying hard to do the right thing and grow illicit crops.
What is the link? I know you've studied this carefully and have a lot to say about the Taliban and other terrorist organizations between drug trafficking and terrorism.
Well, another great question. Let me start. Before 9/11, many leaders in DEA, administrators, chiefs of operations, chiefs of intelligence testified before Congress about drugs funding insurgencies and terrorist groups around the world before 9/11. However, for the most part, before 9/11, we were talking about the usual suspects in the Western Hemisphere, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, the FARC, the Sendero Luminoso in Peru, and the old ELN out of Colombia, all designated foreign terrorist organizations by our country, the FARC designated also by the EU or the European Union and some other countries. But for the most part, before 9/11, that's what we were talking about. Post 9/11, we've seen an alarming monumental change. Over half of the 51 terrorist groups that have been formally designated as foreign terrorist organizations by the U.S. government are now involved in one or more aspects of the global drug trade. And that's out of necessity, Kathleen, because, quite honestly, we've been very successful in working with coalition partners around the globe, and we have been very successful in fighting the global war on terror, which causes these groups to have to turn to other ways of funding their operations, because we have basically shut down two very important funding streams, or significantly disrupted them at least, and that's the funding stream coming from state-sponsored terror, countries that actually sponsor terrorist groups. State sponsorship has diminished significantly, and we've also identified and significantly disrupted funding streams into these terrorist groups from very powerful private donors. So if they're going to keep their movements alive, they've got to pay for them somehow. More and more of them are turning to drugs and other forms of transnational organized crime.
I know that you were asked recently when you testified before Congress about the efforts that are being made to shut down the major opium trafficking routes, especially along the Afghan border. Has that been successful as well, and what did you do in that regard?
Well, it has not been all that successful. It's a very complicated situation, but understand that I've never in decades of experience never seen a successful counter-narcotics strategy in any country that produced drugs, and that would include Afghanistan, that doesn't include three principal pillars. First of all, you've got to have a robust eradication. That is not happening in Afghanistan, at least not successfully. You have to have very strong law enforcement, and you have to have very strong education and prevention campaigns that are going on. Law enforcement and education prevention, there have been some successes in those areas in Afghanistan, but with respect to eradication, it has not been successful. It's not been effective.
Yeah. Tell me about the amount of money that is made in all of these endeavors, how much money a farmer would get, who's making the huge amount of money, why they're getting so much money for trafficking in these drugs?
Well, anecdotally, I'll give you, I think, what would be a perfect example, and it involves Afghanistan. In, I think it was 2000 or 2008, 2009, the DEA, supported strongly by our U.S. military and NATO ISAF forces in Afghanistan, as well as supported by our State Department that provided helicopter support, took down a major heroin cache site in eastern Afghanistan that was operated by a very notorious trafficker who also happened to be one of the five founding fathers of the Taliban ruling Shura in Kabul. The guy's name was Haji Bajko. They missed what they were after, which intelligence led them to believe that I think there was, you know, several hundred, if not even, it may have even been 1,000 kilograms of finished product that were at the compound. They missed the load. It had made its way into Pakistan. But with that said, they were able to seize the ledgers, which clearly showed that Bajko had moved about $169 million worth of heroin through his books over just the previous 7 months. I'm happy to say that DEA, in a very complex operation that was strongly supported and worked bilaterally and jointly, obviously, with the Afghan National Police or Afghan National Counter-Narcotics Police, Bajko is now in a federal penitentiary locked up in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. What do you make of this capture in February of Joaquin Guzman? The headlines of the news I'm looking at right now say that this Mexican drug kingpin was responsible for 25% of the drugs coming into the United States. Is that accurate? Was this a big capture?
Well, it's, you know, it was a major capture. You know, Chapo Guzman was, for all intents and purposes, you know, the equivalent of our John Gotti back in the day, but the similarities end there. John Gotti, on his best day, couldn't have put together $1 million in cash to save his butt. Chapo Guzman was raking in it by all estimates were somewhere between $2 to $3 billion a year in revenue and actually in profit, some believe, and was responsible for much of that roughly $30 to $35 billion of in the drug trade that takes place between Mexico and the United States. You know, he ran you know, one of the, if not the most sophisticated, organized crime operations, not only in Mexico, that had a strong impact on the United States, but probably the most sophisticated organizationally and operationally organized crime entities that that's ever operated anywhere in the world. It's also important to say that more and more of his drugs were headed for growing demand and growing markets in Europe, in Russia, and elsewhere. He's, you know, very, very much responsible for moving tons of poison into our country. But like any Fortune 100 100 company, he diversified his product line over several years, and he was very, very heavily focused on going global.
Mm-hmm. So with his capture, does a cartel disintegrate, Michael, or are there people ready to step up and just take right over?
Well, no, it's not. You're never going to disintegrate a very powerful organized crime group like the Sinaloa cartel, which Chapo headed, by taking down its leader. However, with that said, you can completely dismantle a very powerful cartel, but it takes several years. With the arrest of someone like Chapo Guzman, you know, the leader, the principal leader of the group, it offers law enforcement and the, you know, the entire judicial process with a great opportunity to start chipping away very, very aggressively at the greater organization, because anytime you take down someone like him, even with the best succession plan, the new leader or leaders will have to come into place. Taking down a guy like Chapo forces these organizations to change their tactics, techniques, and procedures. When they do that, they become more vulnerable. And as long as law enforcement doesn't lose, you know, their commitment to completely dismantle the group, they can most assuredly do so over a, you know, a 3 to 5 year period. But these things don't sprout up overnight. You're not going to take them down overnight. Probably two of the best anecdotal examples, or two or three that I can give you, you know, the old Medellin and Cali cartels, those notorious cartels from Colombia, for all intents and purposes, they're dead. All of the old guard is either locked up or in prison. Mm. There may be, you know, some remnants, loose remnants of them, but they're, you know, they're weak at best. And more closely to home in Mexico, the Arellano Felix organization, also known as the old Tijuana cartel, they're not dead, but they don't have nearly the fight that they once had, you know, if you going back just 4 or 5 years ago, when law enforcement, made them experience a number of almost back-to-back setbacks. And that's what you have to do.
Yeah. I'm very curious about how these drugs, particularly heroin, which is so damaging to people, find their way into the United States. How do they get to rural Wisconsin or Vermont? How do people know where they are, and how do they make their way to communities all over the United States? We'll ask Michael that. Michael Braun is our guest, former DEA Chief of Operations, architect for the narco-terrorism programs and the agency's extensive expansion in Afghanistan in their efforts to curb global drug trafficking. We're welcoming phone calls for him. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at @KDunnShow. Michael retired from the DEA as Chief of Operations in 2008 after serving a 33-year domestic and international law enforcement career. He is now managing partner of SGI Global. To your phone calls and your questions about the drug trade, the international drug trade, as we continue here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Michael Braun is our guest, retired Chief of Operations of the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration. Steele in Appleton is our first caller. Hi, Steele.
Yes, Mr. Braun, I find that a big hypocrisy. For years and years, we burn poison land, Central South America, i.e. robust eradication. Reagan years, Oliver North, and the stories of drugs for arms. And we have every arm in the world in Afghanistan. Yet you told us that only 4% came to the U.S. Well, what about all the heroin that went to the rest of the world? And Afghanistan has the highest harvest ever. And that's my comment.
All right. Thanks, Jill.
What was the caller's first name?
His name is Steele.
Steele. Okay. Well, look, you know, great comments. I've spent time in Afghanistan. You know, one of my co-managing partner, Doug Wonkel, who is also a retired chief of operations with DEA, remains in Afghanistan. He's served 12 years there, both pre-Soviet invasion and post-U.S. NATO ISAF occupation. Afghanistan is an enormously complex country, a very complex situation, and until you have physically been on the ground there and traveled the country, throughout the country, and seen the difficulty of the terrain, It's a complex culture. It's very easy to sit back and armchair comments or armchair quarterback, if you will, the successes and the failures of our efforts in Afghanistan. And by, when I say our efforts, I'm talking about, you know, the U.S. government's efforts in Afghanistan. I'm not sure, you know, what else to say. I certainly appreciate and respect the caller's frustration, because with Afghanistan, there's obviously a lot of frustration on the parts of folks in the United States. With that said, I can tell you that DEA lost 3 special agents on an operation in Afghanistan that were side by side with U.S. military personnel raiding a major heroin laboratory that was operated by the Taliban. And DEA has had some other special agents that have been injured in country. The DEA is doing everything that they can to do what they're responsible for. That is the law enforcement piece of it, investigating the most notorious traffickers in the area and the region and bringing them to justice in the United States or to other countries where competent jurisdictions can make sure that a judicial process plays out. But the DEA is not responsible for eradication. The DEA is not responsible for a lot of the rest of the counter-narcotic strategy. And I can also tell you that the DEA does not possess the helicopters nor the firepower to go anywhere in that country at will to get their job done. You know, it's just a very, very difficult place.
Thank you, Steele, for the call. Can you give me, because I have no idea how this happens, Michael, how do the heroin particularly that's coming into the United States find its way to La Crosse, Wisconsin, or to rural Vermont?
Well, it's another great question, Kathleen, and it's, you know, it's a complex situation. But I can say this. Mexican drug trafficking organizations now dominate trafficking throughout the United States. There have been reports that there are, you know, drug trafficking cartel cells and nodes that are operating in anywhere from 300 to 1,500 cities in the United
States. Wow.
I believe 300 is woefully short. I would say that it's somewhere in between, or may be as high as that 1,500 mark. What happened was back in the early to mid 1980s, our government, working with governments throughout Latin America and the Caribbean, had closed the old Caribbean corridor for cocaine that was flowing out of Colombia, destined for the United States. And the Colombian traffickers that were responsible for, I mentioned the Medellin and the Cali cartels years ago, were responsible for moving those drugs into the U.S. And then ultimately turning them over to oftentimes, you know, U.S. Based gangs and other drug traffickers in the United States for distribution. However, what happened was, because of our success in closing down the Caribbean corridor, the Colombians entered into negotiations and ultimately agreements with the Mexican cartels that for literally decades had been moving marijuana, heroin, and to a lesser degree methamphetamine into the western United States. But the Colombians began relying on the Mexican drug trafficking cartels to then move their cocaine across the border. Initially, they were paying the Mexican traffickers in cash to do that, where those loads would then be reconstituted and turned over back over to Colombian trafficking groups. But what happened was, shortly thereafter, the Mexican cartels, smart businessmen, realized that they could be making a lot more money if they were paid in kind, meaning in cocaine rather than cash, and which provided them with an opportunity to start creating markets throughout the United States for cocaine. that, again, that they had received in payment for moving Colombian heroin across the border.
Mm-hmm.
And you flash forward to today, in just 20 or 25 years, the Mexican cartels absolutely control the markets throughout the United States. They move heroin, they move cocaine, they move marijuana, methamphetamine, to a lesser degree, club drugs like GHB, ecstasy, and some other other drugs across the border, and then they move it inland to places like Chicago, throughout Wisconsin, my home state of Missouri, which was once my home state, Missouri, but literally all over the United States, into Alaska, into Hawaii, and as I said earlier, now into Europe. There have even been seizures in southern China that are attributed to a lesser degree, to Mexican drug trafficking organizations.
Goodness.
They move it in myriad ways.
Yeah.
I mean, you name it. Lots of different smuggling methods.
Yeah. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. John in Richland Center is next. Hi, John.
Hi, Kathleen and Michael. I was wondering about the source of these poppy plants, like the eradication and destroying the plants in the fields. Well, my question is, are these organized crime syndicates threatening local authorities to look the other way? Because, I mean, anybody gets a helicopter off the ground in these countries can see those poppy plants.
Is there bribing?
Yeah, good question, John, and you're right. I mean, I've been in Afghanistan when the poppies are in full bloom, and you see purple as far as the eye can see. And you talk to virtually any of our military heroes that have fought for Afghanistan and our country and other freedom-loving countries around the world that have actually fought in Afghanistan, and they can tell you the same thing. You know, you got a combination of a couple things going on here. You've got organized crime, if you will, the traditional traffickers in the Afghanistan-Pakistan region that are very much responsible for what's happening in Afghanistan, but more and more because of our success in prosecuting the global war on terror, groups like the Taliban are relying more and more on the global drug trade to fund their operations. And there are a lot of ways to make lots of money, John, by doing that. In Afghanistan, just like in Colombia with the FARC years ago, when their state sponsor, the Soviet Union, basically disintegrated, came apart at the seams in the early 1990s in the old funding stream from the Soviet Union into Cuba down to groups like the FARC and the Sendero Luminoso, when that dried up almost overnight, those groups, basically had to make some tough corporate decisions very quickly that if they were going to keep their movement alive, they had to get involved in the drug trade. So what happened in Colombia, we're seeing very much the same picture in Afghanistan over the past few years. Taliban got their start in this business by taxing farmers. And then they began to tax the movement of drugs and precursors, drugs going out of the country, precursor chemicals coming into the country. Those precursor chemicals are absolutely necessary for the production and the refinement of poppy into opium, opium into morphine, morphine ultimately into heroin. They began providing security at clandestine cache sites, clandestine laboratories and other places, and then they began to realize that, guess what, there's none of this that we can't do, and we can make a heck of a lot more money if we get ourselves involved in basically every bit of it. And, like the other things I've talked about, this is a very complicated situation. I don't want to overgeneralize it or oversimplify it. But we simply don't have enough time to get into all of the, all of the nasty details. But I think that should help paint you know, a better picture for you and your fellow listeners on, you know, some of the challenges that that we're faced with in Afghanistan.
Oh, I'm sure there are many. Thank you, John, for the call. Dave in Madison sent a message wondering about your statement on use being cyclical. Why is use, particularly of heroin, cyclical?
Well, some believe. Listen, I'm not a doctor. I'm a practitioner. But I've spent 33 years as a law enforcement practitioner, and here's what history seems to show. Many experts strongly believe that addicts will undergo a period where they're abusing strong central nervous system depressants like heroin for a period of time, and when I say that, I'm not talking about, you know, a week or two, but I'm talking about addicts over several years will be on strong central nervous depressants. They try to self-medicate rather than seeking out help from experts, and they'll start to switch to stimulants after a few years, and then you'll see an increase and a rise in the abuse and addiction of stimulants, cocaine, methamphetamine, other drugs like that. It's so some experts believe that it's just a very nasty, never ending cycle. But unfortunately, one that there are a few families in the country that are immune to any of this. We've all, you know, including my family, has experienced just the terrible results of drug addiction and abuse.
Right. Thank you for the question. Let's go to John in Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Oh, hello. Yes, I welcome this discussion. It's very useful, but I wanted to say that if nobody bought and used the stuff, then it wouldn't matter where it came from or how much came in. And so the important answer seemed to lie in the very nature of what kind of stuff this is. We're talking about heroin. Well, I had a recent experience that helped me. I had a moderately severe operation, and so the combination of a good surgeon and then pain management following the operation, it was just wonderful how much it helped me. And then I had an extra accidental gift from that experience, which was that for some reason one evening they didn't have a nurse on duty or something, and I wasn't given pain medication for about 15 hours, and this occurred about 25 or 30 hours after I was operated on. And so there I was with my abdomen sliced open and no pain medicine. And I realized how wonderful the stuff was once they came back on duty and administered the pain medication. So, we don't know how much pain people have had who fall into regular use of heroin. But I think that's what we need.
Yeah, and you never had, after you were recovered, you never had any problem with an opiate addiction, John?
Nah.
Yeah.
None whatsoever. And then I could say that also socially, I have an experience. I've had many friends who were users. I never had a direct personal friend die from overdose or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
But the people I know who use it regularly had suffered just terrible abuse in childhood.
Mm. All right. Thank you very much for the call, John. As you look at all of these drugs, and you've mentioned many of them, are there certain ones that you think are particularly odious and all our efforts should be concentrated on, say, heroin eradication, or do you find them all of the same ilk, Michael?
Well, I'm a guy, again, that spent 33 years in the back alleys and the boardrooms, and watch any episode of Cops. It's not just one particular drug, for God's sakes, that law enforcement and the experts in treatment and prevention and education have to deal with. And understand something, we're the ones that end up cleaning up the nasty messes most of the time. I would say that, you know, they're all bad, and I mean that with all sincerity. If you look at what's happening with heroin abuse, especially among our younger populace right now, We're seeing the same trend over and over again. It starts with marijuana. They move to mom and dad's medicine cabinet, where they might find some oxycodone, OxyContin, if you will, the brand name that's most recognized by folks in the country. Those 30-milligram tabs, those are great, but when they run out, then they, you know, then they're going to try heroin just one time. You know, a week later, you know, they're now hooked. They're addicted to heroin, and some of the stuff that's making its way across the border and onto the streets in the United States is not just heroin. Some of this stuff that's resulted in deaths is heroin that's laced with fentanyl, which is a synthetic form of morphine that is actually somewhere between 60 to 100 times more powerful than morphine, probably the drug that your previous caller, John, was receiving as a result of his abdominal surgery. But it's important to understand, in John's case, I can assure you that the expert medical staff weaned him off of that morphine before he left the hospital, and he probably didn't even realize it, okay? That's not what happens with young people or really anyone that makes the wrong turn in life, makes a very poor decision, and believes that they can head down that path of heroin or OxyContin or even marijuana, because today's marijuana is not the marijuana of the 1960s or 70s. This stuff is routinely being tested now at 40 to 50% plus THC content. It is extremely addictive. And here we go again, an area that's also cyclical, it seems to be. Every 20 or 30 years, we have this big push to let's just legalize all this stuff and all of our problems will go away. And we're starting to see that again. The problem that we've got with that, Kathleen, is, again, the marijuana today is not the marijuana of 20 years ago when we saw the last really, really aggressive push to legalize that particular drug. And quite frankly, it worries me.
What about the marijuana that's regulated that's being sold in Washington and Colorado? That's pretty potent stuff, too?
There are no rules and regulations on the content of tetrahydrocannabinol, the psychoactive ingredient in the marijuana that gives the user his or her high. Mm-hmm. But let's just say that there was, okay? Let's say that we take marijuana back to the THC content that we were experiencing 25 years ago in the country. Good marijuana was maybe 1.5 to 2% THC content. All right. Let's say that we tried to regulate it that way. Does anyone think for a moment, you know, that the dark side of all this, the illicit side of all this, is not going to provide users who choose not to follow the law, not play by the rules, to seek out marijuana that has, you know, that has a much higher THC potency and content? Okay, people across our country really need to educate themselves on this. This is something that needs to be debated. It, you know, science needs to study this. There are over 400 chemical ingredients in marijuana that have never been studied by science. We have no idea what we're getting into. Let science do its job. Let's not let the ballot box take the place of, you know, the FDA process for moving drugs onto market as medicine, which is amazing because that's what's happening throughout the country. And then if science weighs in and says it is really no more dangerous than any other drug that we've legalized, then hell, let's legalize it. But I don't think that, you know, that is not what science is showing.
Michael Braun is our guest this hour, and we're talking this hour. We're doing a series of programs on use of drugs. The first was the show that we did shortly after the death of Philip Seymour Hoffman of the heroin overdose. So we were looking at these stories that surfaced on how extensive heroin use is in rural communities and places where you normally wouldn't think this would be a problem. It has become a very large problem. Today the show is, where are these drugs coming from? What's going on in Afghanistan? What about the Mexican drug kingpin? How many drugs are coming from Mexico? How do they get here? How are they distributed? How do we take on this problem? Later, we'll be talking with some addicts who are recovering. How did they find that successful? And still later, we'll talk about treatments, special treatments, particularly for heroin addiction. Michael Braun is our guest this hour. He's retired chief of operations of the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration. He is now managing partner of SGI Global. He has spent a number of years. He joined the DEA in 1985. He has worked all over the world. And here is how you reach our conversation. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And you can reach us on Twitter at Kate Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls. Will in Madison is next. Hi, Will.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
This is a nice gentleman. May be pleased to know that how he has a job and how he's able to go after the organized crime groups dealing in drugs started actually here in northern Wisconsin under when Melvin Laird was a congressman, and then he became Secretary of Defense and Nixon in the 1970s. They created the Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, RICO Act. That started here in northern Wisconsin.
All right. Are you familiar with that act, Michael?
Yes, I am. And it was Richard Nixon that actually founded the DEA. I mean, its DEA can track its lineage all the way back to the 1930s with the Federal Bureau of Narcotics. It was President Nixon that actually formed the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration. I happen to have liked the guy, but one of the biggest mistakes that I think was ever made in the fight against drugs and drug trafficking, drug abuse, drug addiction, was a very poorly coined metaphor by President Nixon, the war on drugs. Listen, there's not a war on drugs. There's never been a war on drugs in our country, and I don't think there ever will be. When you look at a war, a soldier's job, longstanding U.S. military doctrine, a soldier identifies, seeks out, and destroys the enemy with overwhelming firepower. That's not what law enforcement does, and hopefully that's not what we will ever do. Law enforcement identifies, investigates, works very closely with prosecutors to indict. They then arrest and ultimately try, hopefully get a conviction, and lock up some very bad people for a very long time. It's probably one of the most important things that I can say is that something you will never, ever hear on the media is that, well, what you do here is we've lost the war on drugs. Again, there's never been a war on drugs. But the reality of the situation is this. There are somewhere between 45 to 50% fewer people abusing drugs in our country today than there were at the height of the problem during our most recent era of drug abuse in our country, which was 1979. Almost 50% fewer people. Okay? Law enforcement can take a little bit of the credit. The professionals in treatment and prevention and education deserve a lot of that credit. But the reality of the situation is if some medical group had reduced the incidence of diabetes or AIDS by 50% since 1979, somebody'd be getting a Nobel Prize. Our country, like any democracy, any democratic country around the world, okay, struggles with drug abuse. That's what free societies, it's just part of being free, all right? One of the biggest periods or eras of drug abuse and addiction in our country was the 40-year period after the Civil War, when one in every 200 Americans was addicted to either cocaine are coca-based elixirs, are opiates of some type, and opiate types of elixirs, because they could go in any drugstore anywhere in the country and buy the stuff off the shelf without a prescription. Okay? What does that sound like to me? We've been down the road of legalization in that era with very powerful drugs, and it simply didn't work. And actually, in the 1920s, by the late 1920s, that's where America's drug laws began to be formed by Congress, because families all over the country that were suffering with addiction told their congressmen, you've got to step in and regulate this stuff and do something about it. All right? That's where it all started.
Well, when you say 50% fewer people are using drugs, Michael, why are we seeing press report after press report pointing to the heroin use epidemic in this country?
I'm talking about all drugs.
Okay.
All right, all drugs. But I was a local police officer for 4 years in my hometown of Cape Girardeau, Missouri, after I got out of the Marine Corps, and I was working my way through college on the GI Bill. I was with the Illinois State Police for 7 years before I joined the ranks of DEA. I was fortunate in that I worked patrol as well as narcotics, you know, throughout my my local and state career.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you, as an undercover agent in the 1970s, things were far more out of control then as they are today. Do we still have drug abuse and addiction in our country? We absolutely do. You know, is one victim one too many? Absolutely. But we have done a tremendous job at getting putting a lid on this and controlling it as best we can. And we've even reduced drug addiction numbers in this country over the last four decades. But, you know, that doesn't sell newspapers, Kathleen.
Let's go to Margaret in Milwaukee. Hi, Margaret.
Hi. I just wanted to know what he thought about television's glamorization of these drugs, and is that part of the cause of import of these drugs? And I'll take my comment off the air.
All right, Margaret.
Hey, Margaret. Thanks for the comments. Thanks for the question. And I wish more folks thought like you did, or like you do. If there's one thing that bothers me more about what's happening today is the glamorization of drugs on TV, in the movies. If you're in your 30s and you choose to make a really stupid decision and start down the wrong path, okay, then so be it. But the problem is that so many young people, are fixated, far too many kids fixated on TV because mom and dad are both working and they get home from school. And what do? They turn the TV on. I mean, I raise kids. I know what goes on. And they see this, and they think that it's okay. But part and parcel of all this also, though, is this idea that smoked marijuana is medicine, therefore it can't be bad for you. I mean, anyone in any of the states that have now voted to legalize marijuana, smoked marijuana as medicine, really needs to take a hard look in the mirror, because they're contributing to all this also. And Kathleen, I think one of your, I believe it was John, a couple of callers ago, basically talked about if there weren't users, we wouldn't be having this problem. I mean, he's absolutely right. You know, it's our fellow Americans' insatiable appetite to be selfish and to not play by the rules when they know what the laws are and what the laws aren't, to go ahead and abuse, myriad types of drugs. I would go as far to say the drugs that they're abusing, there's money tied to all of that. Their money that's going back to places like Colombia, that makes its way back to places like Mexico and makes its way ultimately back to a lesser degree to places like Afghanistan. But there's blood on their hands. That is nothing more than blood money. America, our citizens who are attempting to satisfy their insatiable appetites for drugs really need to take a hard look in the mirror tomorrow morning and realize what it is that they're doing to contributing to global instability and some of the most horrific murders and that kind of thing that are taking place in far-off locations because of their selfishness.
Thank you, Michael. We're out of time. Michael Braun, our guest, recently retired Chief of Operations of the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration. Next show, we're going to be looking at, we're going to talk with recovering addicts, and we're particularly interested in what I think is one of the really bad, bad drugs, and that's heroin. Find out if there's a difference among various addictions and how you can conquer it. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour and for on-air production.